Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox. Welcome to the award-winning Life with GDPR. In this episode, Jonathan is on a short hiatus, so I'm joined by Karen Moore to take a deep dive into the EU's Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive. I know you'll enjoy it. Now a word from this month's sponsor of the Compliance Podcast Network, Ethico.
Handling multiple compliance cases can often feel like navigating a complex labyrinth. Ethico introduces simplicity and intelligence into this chaos with our custom workflow automation. By automatically routing cases based on your unique criteria, we turn the maze into a clear path forward. Envision a compliance process that's not just effective, but also intuitive and adaptable to your needs. It's time to redefine efficiency in your workplace. Embark on this journey of transformation at ethico.com/CPN. Book a demo, read our white paper by Tom Fox titled The ROI of Compliance, and try our free ROI calculator to discover a world of seamless compliance management.
If we want to wait for the regulators to tell us what's ethical instead of doing it ourselves as a corporate universe, then we're really asking for trouble. And one good example of that is arguably is the recently and nearly fully adopted Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, or the CSDDD. And I just wanted to step back a little bit and just look at the bigger picture here, because here we have a 113-page directive with a lot of depth to it, and I've got lots and lots of pages of notes, which I will try and boil down to some of the kind of salient points, at least the ones that struck me. But it occurred to me that if you step back and say, as a corporation, we need to ensure that we're not harming the environment unduly, that the people we do business with are not harming the environment unduly, that we are respecting human rights, livable wages, disadvantaged communities, all these things that as a corporation, when we act, we have an effect on that kind of big pool of stakeholders, and just try and do our best, then we're halfway there. And I felt that way when the GDPR came out as well. If you start from the perspective of, I have got John Doe's individual personal information, how am I using it? How am I letting John know how I'm using it? How am I protecting it? Where am I going with it? You already are halfway to compliance with the GDPR. Not all the way, because there's a lot of nuance there, but it really comes down to, are we consciously trying to do the right thing? And the last kind of intro comment I'll make there is, Jonathan, last time I was privileged to be on this pod, I was talking about whistleblowers and whistleblower protection legislation, and you asked me, what can we do to make sure that whistleblowers are in a good spot? And I had a bit of a confused answer because there's so many moving parts to it. But again, in the really simplified manner is, if you don't want whistleblowers, don't do stupid things that mean that whistleblowers feel that need to blow the whistle. Respect the environment, respect personal rights, respect the impact that you have on the community, act fairly, play within the rules, be smart, make money, do right by your shareholders. But it really comes down to that. So I'm sorry, because I guess I used up my rant opportunity. So let me dive into the CSDDD, which, by the way, I was predicting the death knell of a couple of months ago, which was obviously too early, because on the 15th, the European Council actually approved a greatly revised version after some kind of sit-down protests by Germany, Italy, and France. Some interesting political maneuvering there. So it's just got one tiny little hurdle now with the European Parliament, which meets on the 24th of April. And then there's a two-year window, not for it to go into effect so much as for the 27 EU member states to transpose this into national law. And for those of you who aren't working with EU law every day, just a kind of distinction between a regulation like the GDPR, which goes into effect for all the member states once adopted, versus a directive, which is basically saying, here are the minimum standards. Each one of you 27 member states now should transpose this into your own national laws, which is actually still going on with the whistleblower directive, which has been now mostly transposed, but even though it's well past the deadline, hasn't been transposed by all 27 member states, even when adopted on the 24th. And I hope I'm on better solid ground for predictive outcomes, then the member states have 24 years still. I'm sorry, 2 years to transpose it into national law, in which case it will then start to apply, but in a really stepped in way, which I'll briefly cover in a moment. But for people who are listening, who are thinking, does this even apply to me? I'm not an EU company. I don't have even huge operations in the EU. It does have a pretty broad scope, even though the initial kind of barrier to entry, if you will, is relatively high. It also does cover companies operating outside the EU who have any kind of operations or income from the EU, provided they're relatively significant. But even if you have no office, no operations in the EU, you are very likely to be a supplier of goods or services to an EU company, which itself may be subject to the directive, in which case you really are getting a big heads up on what demands are going to be placed on you. Because unlike other national iterations of this law, for example, the law that we have currently in force in Germany, this doesn't apply just to your tier one suppliers. It goes down the chain and up the chain, frankly, to your suppliers plus their suppliers. And that's both upstream, who are your suppliers of spare parts, of raw materials, transportation, warehousing, and the like, but also downstream a bit too, in terms of who else is going to be in your supply chain. So you need to know these things, both if you are subject to it, and then also if you are supplying to a company which is subject to this regulation. So we have some breathing space, like we did with GDPR, but it's good to start planning where are you in scope and what parts of your activities are in scope. We can expect in late 2026, early 27, when these things enter into national law, it's going to start applying. And this was big compromises, I think, as a result of the Germany, Italy, France objections, a real change from the lower barrier initially. So it'll start applying to companies with 5,000 or more employees and 1.5 billion euros in net turnover. Over 2028, it goes down to 3,000 employees, 900 million, 2029, 1,000 employees, and 450 million in revenue. So it's good to know if you're being caught up or any of your key customers are caught up in that over time. The penalties are not small. It's up to 5% of your net worldwide turnover. It's going to be enforced locally with some sort of EU federal type oversight body. There is a direct right of action by people who feel that they've been directly harmed by violation of the law. That's something to consider, whether we're going to end up with, I keep making analogies to the GDPR, and I recognize this is a very different animal, but if we're going to have a kind of new Max Schrems law student who decides they're going to make their name in these direct right of actions and start holding companies accountable. And it can be also a bar, violations can be a bar to public contract bidding. So it can be important there. They have promised more guidelines. That's good as well. If you're outside the EU, you should designate somebody locally. So that's important as well. And I almost don't even know where to go. And Tom, I'm going to count on you to just pull the plug, because this could be, we could do part two, part three, part four, part five of this, but there is a lot of detail in there. I'm just going to focus on the overall scope that it covers, and then a couple of open questions I have that we're all going to be asking ourselves. So this covers human rights and also environmental impact. So it's a pretty broad range. It's aligned with a lot of other legislation, including the OECD guidelines for businesses. So it incorporates them almost by reference to know what does human rights and environmental impact mean. It is focused on due diligence. So it's that whole know who you're dealing with component. This is not the CSRD, which is akin to the SEC disclosure rules, which talks about what do you need to disclose about your actions. And I saw it, by the way, yesterday, just as an aside, that the SEC has voluntarily set aside the implementation implementation of the disclosure rules pending outcomes, I guess not unexpected, to different challenges. I think they're waiting to hear from the Court of Appeals in the Eighth Circuit. SEC was in place and now it's temporarily not in place. But so it's not any of the disclosures. It's just like, what do you know and what are you going to do about it? You need to conduct impact assessments, both on the potential and also actual human rights and environmental issues that may occur not only in your own activities, but in your suppliers and your indirect suppliers as well. You need to then prevent, mitigate, and potentially end actual harm and potential harm. You need to track progress at least once a year. You need to publish an annual statement on your website in terms of what you're doing, where you're going. You need a compliance procedure. And this is where it starts to get into the, isn't this procurement? Why should compliance care? It's really starting to sound like a big compliance program, right? You need compliance anti-retaliation. It'll cross-reference into the whistleblower laws that were recently put in place, and now they're going to amend those to specifically cover this. You need a really big policy. That policy should also take into account employee opinions. You have to have a consultation period with your employees or their representatives. So if you have trade unions, et cetera, you need to involve them as well. That policy should, by the way, apply to temporary workers as well, which means that they probably need to be trained. So that's that whole other can of worms on how do you address temporary or shift employees. You need to incorporate it into your risk assessment. And then you have this whole huge due diligence, as I mentioned, both upside and downstream as well. So any kind of raw material parts development, manufacture, design, storage, and transport. Downstream, any partners that are carrying out activities on your behalf. Again, distribution, transportation, storage. You need to take care of all that. And then that impact assessment that I mentioned, which can now go, you know, hand in hand with your privacy impact assessment already required in a lot of cases by the GDPR, not to mention all the cybersecurity assessments you have to do. And my very first big question is, what on earth does this mean for due diligence and that whole know your third party? Those questionnaires are getting longer and longer and longer. Our ability, I think, now to try and incorporate better AI to sort out by risk what questions are being asked to which third party is going to be crucial, because who's sifting through the responses? Even if your third party is willing to answer 500 questions covering the wide range of issues that we're supposed to be looking at, whether it's financial or legal or cybersecurity, who's going to sort through the answers and decide what needs follow-up? To what degree are we relying on the self-reporting and the accuracy of those reports and the like? So being able to really pinpoint, this is the supplier with these risks, I need to ask them these questions, number one, to try and simplify it. Number two is, to what extent are we going to start to see the ability to get some sort of a certification process in place, whether something like EcoVadis or something more akin to the ISSD, to say, look, I already have this certification and therefore I don't need to answer questions. You can already rely on that, although the directive kind of takes issue with that. I think really number one big question is, how do you even do this due diligence? Number two is, how many suppliers do you have and are they necessary? Do you need to diversify? And it's created all sorts of problems for companies, Boeing and even like for NASA, when they have to distribute their supply chain all over the place to satisfy different political or financial demands. You know, can you reduce the number of suppliers and really get to know them and really develop trust and relationships with them that'll give you a little bit more breathing space? Question number two is, even if you trust and believe in your suppliers, what about their suppliers? Because now you're responsible for what I'm loosely calling the blueberry problem, that if you contract for muffins to be delivered to your office every day and you love the baker and the baker is really great, what is the baker doing about ensuring that the blueberries that they put in your muffins have been sustainably sourced and that the people picking the blueberries have received a fair wage? So it is going to start to take that kind of thinking about, where are things coming from? How am I going to work with my suppliers? And there's a very interesting set of provisions about working with small, medium enterprises in the CSDDD that says that you need to be co-responsible, even to the point of potentially providing direct financing or enabling low-cost loans or whatever, so that your SME suppliers are also able to comply with this legislation. So So it's a degree of accountability that I think doesn't necessarily exist by regulation, alongside a very interesting provision that says, if necessary, you can work with your competitors who may also be contracting with your indirect suppliers to encourage, if not force, those indirect suppliers to comply with the law. So now we have a kind of competition tightrope to navigate there. I'm going to pick a couple of other little observations and points here, because like I said, there's a lot in these 113 pages, and I think that they really bear further conversation or further examination. And as we get more information and supporting documentation from the European Union, we'll also be able to get better guidance. But how are you going to staff this? The German law already says you should have a human rights officer in charge of implementing the current German version of this due diligence kind of regulation and activity. What kind of technology are you going to use that you're maybe not already using to try and sort through all of this? Can you reduce the number of suppliers? And then this kind of interaction with other laws, because there are already other laws on the books with the EU. So that's my really very kind of brief impressions of this law, which is due to be adopted in a couple of weeks, and it's going to slowly start to enter into force. But Matt, to your point, it's not a bad idea to already start thinking about, am I doing good things that are already complying with the spirit of this law, not to mention all the surrounding laws, and then also which will enable me, once the SEC is back online and CSRD, which is already in force, enable me to properly report and respond to issues and concerns. Yeah, Jonathan, I'm absolutely with you. And by siloing a lot of these kinds of subjects, you also create little power bases within an organization that don't necessarily coordinate with other parts of the organization. We're already seeing the rise of the data privacy officer within different countries. So it's not the strategic position, it's the individual country position saying, we have to do this, we must do that, we're not complying with this, we're in default, I have an external obligation to report the company. Are we going to now start seeing human rights officers doing the same thing without a kind of coordinated strategic ability to address? Back to Matt's point, how do we just operate fairly and do make a best effort to operate as a company? One thing I do with my law students, we do a whole bunch of reading on the whole argument between stakeholder capitalism and shareholder capitalism. And they start out completely on the stakeholder capitalist corner. And as we start examining some of the challenges, they slowly start moving, not all the way over, a lot more centric to say, you can't make everybody happy all the time. We're still a for-profit organization. And if you're not a big organization and you're the sole chief compliance officer, who's now also the chief privacy officer and now the chief human rights officer and trying to deal with cyber issues as well, where does that leave a corporation to do anything more than start checking boxes? I don't know. Yeah, I think the European Commission actually website is probably one of the best places you can go. It not only has the current text, it has a comparison to prior versions so that you can see what was politically needed to get this through, but it also starts to plug in a lot more resource. It has links to related laws. You can go down a real rabbit hole there. You can look at the OECD requirements. You can look at some of the draft legislation coming up. And one of the mandates actually in the CSDDD is for each nation state to put up its own informational website. So those will be available. So I say go straight to source. It's probably your best bet. I've seen not just some misinformation, but there's a lot out there. If you start doing CSDDD Google searches, that's based on the prior draft of the law. And so there's some kind of misapprehension there about its scope.
Yeah, first of all, Jonathan, my heartfelt condolences. I know you've got a lot of amazing memories of your dad that are going to help you through a very tough time. And I love all your comments about just doing the right thing. It seems to be the theme of today's podcast. So great honor to your dad, too, and reflecting his values. I do have one question for you, especially with the Star Trek reference, which I love. Sometimes we focus so much on the rules, we forget about getting to the right place the right way. And how important is it for for compliance officers to really enforce the rules. If the person who maybe is violating some of them is still in control, they're not doing any harm and they're getting to the destination they need.
This is Tom Fox again. As I mentioned at the start of this episode, Ethico is sponsoring the entire Compliance Podcast Network for this month. I hope you will check out the white paper I have prepared on the ROI of compliance as well as the Ethico ROI calculator. Both could be invaluable to you for internally funding your compliance program. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the award-winning Life with GDPR, where Karen Moore joined me as Jonathan Armstrong is on hiatus. I hope you'll plan to join Jonathan and I again for our next episode of Life with GDPR. Life with GDPR is a special production of the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.